What do you think of when you hear the word circus? Probably not a college campus. I'm Lindsay Moon, and today on Focus, I'll talk with Marcus Alwan. He's the director of the Gamma Phi Circus at Illinois State University, which is one of the oldest and largest collegiate circuses in the country. This week kicks off their final kids' circus camp for the summer, and he'll tell me more about what you do at a circus camp and about how you get started learning about the circus arts. He'll also tell me about why Bloomington Normal has such a rich circus history and about when the Gamma Phi Circus was founded. Then, during the second half of today's program, we'll listen back to a conversation I had with Duncan Wall earlier this spring. He's author of the book The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. We'll hear more about how he flew trapeze for the first time without a harness, and we'll learn more about the history of the circus in the U.S. and in Europe. That's all coming up on Focus after this news. Good morning, and welcome to Focus. I'm Lindsay Moon. Today on the show, we're going to talk about the circus, which has deep roots in East Central Illinois. During the second part of the hour, we'll listen back to a conversation I had with Duncan Wall earlier this spring. He's author of The Ordinary Acrobat, a book about a year he spent on a Fulbright scholarship at the age of 23 studying the circus in France. We'll hear about how he flew trapeze for the first time without a harness, and we'll talk with him a little bit about circus history. But first, I want to welcome Marcus Alwan to the show. He's director of Gamma Phi Circus at Illinois State University, which is one of the largest student-run circuses in the country. Marcus, welcome to Focus.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
So we'll hear about this a little bit later in the hour, but circus does have deep roots in East Central Illinois. Can you tell me a little bit about Gamma Phi Circus and how you guys got started?
Sure. Gamma Phi Circus got started in 1929 when a PE professor here at the university requested permission to start a gymnastics, circus, acrobatics organization or fraternity, and it quickly grew from just an athletic fraternity into a circus, and that just kind of happened as a natural evolution because there were so many circus acrobats, particularly flying trapeze artists, who wintered here because they would come here into Central Illinois because of an abundance of barns that in the wintertime they could set up their rigging, even though they weren't performing on the road, and even though it was cold outside, they were able to still practice their art indoors in some barns that weren't being used in the area.
I was reading on your guys' website, Gamma Phi Circus is one of the oldest circus organizations of its kind in the country. Is that correct?
We are the oldest collegiate circus in the nation, yes.
How many other places in the country do have college circuses? I thought it was really unique that that was an organization that a college would have.
It is a pretty unique thing. It used to be much more common. However, now, on the scale that we have, it's really us and Florida State University. So Illinois State University and Florida State University have what I would call the only two full circus programs. And then there's a number of organizations popping up with circus clubs or unicycle clubs, juggling clubs. Aerials are becoming much more common and as well as becoming a lot more accepted within other universities as well. So some of the aerial arts and aerial dance are actually showing up on a lot of other campuses, which we're excited to see.
So back in the early 1900s, Illinois State had a full circus. Is Gamma Phi still a functioning circus, and can people come see you guys perform?
Absolutely. Every year in April, usually around the third weekend of April, we perform a full show. This last year, in 2013, we were able to have one of our biggest audiences ever, where we performed three shows over 2 days for the public, and we had about 12,500 people come to see those shows. And each year, we've been growing over the last several years, and we're very excited to still be living out that vision that was originally started in the late 1920s and certainly into the 30s.
One of the things that we'll hear about in the second half of the program when I talk with Duncan is that circus was really popular about 100 years ago, and then it kind of fell off, and now there's like a resurgence happening. Can you tell me a little bit how that looks at Illinois State, or did it ever fall off, or have you guys always maintained the audience base that you hope for?
Well, we've always been a strong presence here at Illinois State University, and that's been due to the support of the university, but the students are always excited to come see somebody who they're sitting next to in calculus class performing on a trapeze rig or something like that. And so throughout the years, we've always had a steady presence here at the university with a few years of hiatus during World War II when the university was on a very scaled-down version of itself. But otherwise, we've had a very strong presence here. And when the dawn of movies and other forms of media kind of took over and circuses started to fade away a little bit, in the last 15 years or so, we've been able to see a big resurgence in circus, as you mentioned, and that's due to so many different factors, as I'm sure you'll address in the second part of your program, but it's exciting to be a part of that right now and to see the students who now have the ability to just look at different videos on YouTube or be able to buy DVDs and things like that to see what's possible, and then they bring it into the gym and they decide that the specific things that they want to work on, and then the energy builds off of each other as well as things that are happening outside of our community, and it's just really nice, fun atmosphere to be a part of.
When people come to see a circus, a Gamify circus, what types of acts can you expect?
We have a pretty full range of acts that we perform. We don't have any big animals or anything like that, but we were based out of gymnastics. We kind of came alongside of the gymnastics program until in the 70s or so we split, and so now we no longer have gymnasts that are competing in gymnastics and also performing in Gamify Circus and vice versa. We have so we do have a lot of acrobatic-based, ground-based acts, but we've also got a full aerial program with aerial silks and lyric hoop and multi-trapeze, a few other acts that we kind of came up with ourselves and put together. It's a full circus program, as you would see with any other circus coming through town, aside from big animals.
And just because Gamify is associated with the university, that doesn't mean that it's just college students that are part of this organization.
The vast majority are college students. We are open to full-time students, faculty, and staff of the university. So we will get 1 to 2 faculty or staff that are here at the university and want to be a part of the circus. They need to audition just like everyone else for our show. But I would say 98% of the performers are undergraduate students here at Illinois State.
You mentioned audition, so people that are a part of the circus are going to have some sort of, you know, base knowledge or training. How do people learn about circus and are ready to audition?
Well, many of our performers do come from a gymnastics, dance, or cheerleading background, and that certainly helps. When I'm recruiting students here at the campus to audition for our show, I'm generally looking for athletes, those who have been coached before, who are willing to listen to their coaches and the critiques that we'll have for them, and who are athletic and looking for an organization to keep them active and keep them involved. I myself did not come from an acrobatic, gymnastics, circus background by any means. I came here as a student, an undergraduate student, and I was a soccer player in high school, and we didn't have men's soccer here at Illinois State by the time I made it here. And I found circus and just immediately fell in love with it. It was one of the things that has really kind of become certainly a major part of my life and my career as I've graduated and gone on with some other shows and then came back. But the main thing we're looking for are students who are willing to learn and put themselves out there, and who will listen to their coaches and critiques, because we'll be able to help them along quickly to get to a level of performing that they may have otherwise not known was even possible. We spend the first part of our year preparing for auditions. So we bring in students and we show them all the different things we do, and then we take about a month and a half to get them ready for auditions. And then in mid-October is when we hold our auditions, and everybody auditions every year for the particular acts that they want to perform. So it's difficult, particularly difficult for new people coming in because they're going side by side with a senior who's been performing for 3 years before that point. But it's always a great environment in our gym where there's collaboration and people want to teach the things that they've learned because they remember that there were seniors who taught them when they were freshmen, and it's a really nice atmosphere, fun environment.
You know, when you talk about people being in a gym auditioning for the circus, I'm picturing like clowns, lots of people with makeup on, but one of the things that I think is really interesting is that circus is an art, but it's also kind of a sport. So can you tell me a little bit about how you prepare people to be ready for something like that?
Sure. There is an immense level of athleticism involved in performing with the circus. And we encourage and require regular physical conditioning from all of our performers, whether they're a tumbler or acrobat or a clown, a juggler. We do have many performers who will perform in multiple acts, but regular physical conditioning is an everyday part of what we do. And we bring in, this year we were able to bring in a registered dietitian to talk about healthy eating and how to fuel their body for the things that they're doing. We bring in as many experts as we can to talk about physical fitness and to even lead some of our conditioning and our group conditioning. And it really does take an amazing level of athleticism. And even for some of those acts that you wouldn't think would need it, such as juggling or clowns, we incorporate quite a bit of acrobatics in what we do, no matter what the act is. And so that requires an immense level of dedication and physical fitness.
This summer, you guys do have some circus camps going on. Can you tell me a little bit about those and what will be involved?
Sure. This is probably our 16th year of having summer camps that we've been providing. And each year we've gotten better and better response from people from all over the country who come in and want to learn circus skills. And we range from toddlers around age three and four, and then we have another camp for ages 5 to 8. And then our main camps are geared toward 7 and up. And so we've even had some grandfather and his grandkids come in, and we've had all of them in camp together. But it's a really fun atmosphere. It's a fun time for the students who at Gamify Circus who have been spending even years honing their skills to be able to share that and teach others, as well as for those campers who are coming in and maybe have never even seen a circus before, but are able to try all the different things we do, even Russian swing and some of the bigger acts. We're able to hone those and scale those to a level that will make it safe for even a 7-year-old to perform. And so it's one of my favorite times of the year. It's such a great joy to watch the kids come in, whether they have fears or not. Some of them are fearless and some of them are very timid, but to watch them grow and in just the time of a week to 2 weeks, they hone some amazing skills. And one of the best parts is when they come back year after year, and then you get to watch them grow as a person, as well as a performer. So it's really fun and exciting to watch that each year.
Do you have kids that come to the camps that end up attending Illinois State because they want to be a part of the circus?
We do. That does happen from time to time, and we have a performer right now who was involved with our camps, and she just finished her freshman year here at Illinois State University, and we look forward to having her back next year. And that's happened a number of times. The other thing we're seeing quite a bit of is alumni from Illinois State University who have graduated, and now their kids are coming to our camps. And so that's always fun to see. There's people that I performed with when I was an undergraduate student here whose kids are now coming to our camps, and we always enjoy seeing that.
That sounds very welcoming, non-intimidating environment to learn some of those things in, but I'm sure there are still some of us that are kind of skeptical and are wary of circus as a hobby. What do you say to those people?
Well, I think if anything, especially regarding youth circus and camps and that kind of thing, one thing that I like to tell people when they say, "Oh, I could never do that," is that certainly there are exceptional performers and exceptional athletes out there, and they are the ones that can completely blow somebody's mind. But things like learning to juggle or even walk a tight wire and honing balance and those kinds of things, everybody has room to improve, and it is the kind of thing that I will likely never sit down at a piano and play the way Mozart did. However, I can learn to play a song. I can learn to play a tune, and it's the same kind of a thing for circus. An average person might not ever be able to come in and learn to do a backflip on a tight wire, but they could learn to walk across that tight wire just by honing those skills and working at it, and it's very valuable in that process of learning. So that is something that I always try to relate to people and get them to understand that these are everyday people who are exceptional in their skills and in their talents, but they all started from the same place and it's such a worthwhile experience to take an opportunity to learn something like flying trapeze or whatever it might be, just as one of those things that you can always know that that's something you've done at one point in your life.
So as I mentioned at the very beginning of the interview, a lot of people have misconceptions about what circus is. What is the one thing that you want people to know about circus in Illinois?
Well, I think the history and heritage of circus in central Illinois, particularly in Bloomington Normal, is so rich. And what I love about the Gamify Circus and what I think I would like for people to understand about it or know about it is that we're not necessarily even trying to produce performers who are going to go on and perform professionally with Cirque du Soleil or other big shows. Although we're thrilled when that happens, and it does happen from time to time, we try to use circus as a way to hone life skills for people. We teach cooperation, we teach hard work, dedication, trust, all those things that are so valuable in the world, and even just working together, because we have a group of about 90 to 100 students who come from very different backgrounds, very different personalities and temperaments, and they need to learn to get along and work together, and the circus is the perfect environment to encourage that and to help people kind of hone those life skills, and we love being able to do that in such a unique way.
Where can we find out about Gamify Circus on the web to find out about upcoming events or activities that you guys have planned?
GamifyCircus.IllinoisState.edu. It's kind of a long website address, but even just typing in Gamify Circus to any search engine will come right up. And then we also have a Facebook page and students have been working on getting a Twitter page fully or a Twitter account fully going and those kinds of things. So we're certainly out there. But just searching for Gamify Circus or ISU Circus will certainly bring us up, and you'll be able to find our website.
Okay, thanks very much for talking with me today.
Absolutely, my pleasure.
You're listening to Focus on WILL. I'm Lindsay Moon, and I've been talking this half hour with Marcus Alwan. He's director of Gamify Circus at Illinois State University. You can find out more about them and their circus camps by visiting us online at will.illinois.edu/focus. We're going to take a short break, but when we come back, we'll listen back to a conversation I had with Duncan Wall earlier this spring. He's author of the book The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus. This is Focus on WILL. We'll be right back. And we're back on Focus on WILL. I'm Lindsay Moon. We're going to switch gears and talk a little bit about the history of the circus. Duncan Wall is author of the book The Ordinary Acrobat, A Journey into the Wondrous World of the Circus, Past and Present. He joined me earlier this spring. Duncan Wall, welcome to Focus.
Thank you for having me.
So, Duncan, I think when most people think about the circus, we think Barnum and Bailey's with a ringmaster clad in riding boots with a red jacket, but that's not exactly how you describe the circus in your book.
Yeah, I mean, that is a type of circus that exists. I think what I discovered when I first discovered the circus, and the book kind of tells that story as well, is that it's only a type of circus, that there are actually many other types of circus that are more potentially contemporary, potentially more creative, and that don't necessarily correspond to those particular cliches in our head.
What is circus, then?
What is circus? It's funny, because circus is in this period right now where there's a lot of debate about the art form. It's actually, you know, traditionally we talk about traditional circus and contemporary circus or modern circus, and you know, that's not unique to circus. In almost every art form, there's the notion of the traditional versus the contemporary. In dance, for instance, there's modern dance, and then there's kind of classical dance, which is ballet. In poetry, there's things like iambic pentameter, right, where you kind of adhere to certain codes, and then there's a more contemporary form of poetry, which is easier, more looser and more open. Circus went through that same shift in the 70s, and now basically, you know, people are trying to figure out what it means to do circus. So the question, what is circus, is actually kind of a loaded question. There are those who say that a circus has to be held in a ring, for instance, that it has to include, you know, physical performance, including clowning, including acrobatics, including wire walking, that there's specific types of circus art that you have to include. Other people are more open. They say it can be a kind of combinatory act, art. So any kind of theater that involves like lots of different types of physical performance or lots of different types of any kind of virtuosic act could be a circus. I think I tend to fall more into the latter camp.
This also might be a loaded question from some of the descriptions you give in the book, but with that, are we talking about something like Cirque du Soleil?
Yeah, Cirque du Soleil. I mean, it's funny because I have this conversation with a lot of people, and I've had it a lot over the last month as the book has come out, and like the best thing in terms of introducing people to New Circus is just to show it to them, right? It's like to put a bunch of videos online and show them the clips. And that's what I do when I sort of make a new friend. I sit them down, because of course it's this awkward thing, right? When you explain that you're from the circus, and it's like, oh, so would you know, do we train elephants? And I'm like, actually, no. In fact, it's a little more like dance and theater. Like, here, come over, sit next to me, and we'll watch some clips and start to understand. So Cirque du Soleil is a good starting point. Like, it's a good place to say, you know, that's a type of circus that doesn't correspond to, you know, the cliches you mentioned earlier, but it's certainly not the most progressive circus. I mean, Cirque du Soleil is over 25 years old now. You know, it's been around, they've kind of dominated the world, and they're doing their thing. So it's sort of like a gateway drug.
If we're talking about circus as more of an art form, you know, you made some comparisons between ballet. So we can talk about Russian ballet, American ballet. Can you make those same kinds of parallels when you talk about circus art?
Yeah, totally. I mean, it was funny. There's a book that came out last year called Apollo's Angels, two years ago, and it was about the history of ballet. And she, and it was sort of the first big cultural history. It was like a New York Times notable book for the year. And she goes through and she describes the evolutions of ballet almost culturally, like you're saying, like she'll spend a chapter exploring Russian ballet. And I read it, and the whole time I was thinking, oh my gosh, like this is absolutely, I mean, you could do this exact same book about circus. Like you could do, you know, a lot of the comments that she makes about ballet in those given countries is also true of circus in those countries, which is kind of fascinating. So for instance, like take Russian ballet, right? It's known as being kind of virtuosic. It's known as having a certain emotional quality that other forms don't have. Russian circus is kind of the same way. It's really virtuosic. It's really technically really proficient. Some of the best acrobats you'll see are Russians. They tend to be kind of like, emotional in that kind of classic, passionate Russian way without necessarily always transferring those motions into creativity. So a French circus, for instance, might be more abstract and also kind of emotional, but also more creative in the way of the French.
Are there markers of American circus?
Absolutely. I mean, America's hard. It's you know, this is something that, so I organized a series of events last month called Circus Now, which is basically to demonstrate contemporary circus around the country. And part of what we observed about American circus is there's a lot that's happening, right? And we wanted to show that off to audiences. But one of the things I observed, too, was that as far as performance goes, there's also a kind of attachment to the past in America that you don't see in other countries as much. It's you know, I talk a bit about it in the book, but it's largely because the American circus was so popular. To give a kind of context, like when you know, in the 19th century, when a circus star would travel from America to Europe, his name would be written up in the newspaper, you know, the way as if you were like a general or a famous politician. If a circus star got hurt, you know, Mae Worth, who could do this amazing backflip on a horse, she got hurt once, and it was front page news in the New York Times. I mean, the circus was a cultural institution that was beyond anything that's that we have today as far as live performance goes. It was really more like Hollywood. It was more like professional sports, you know, like it was the NBA and Warner Brothers combined. That kind of power, though, was amazing in terms of the circus then, but it also left a kind of cultural legacy, which is hard to shed, right? The type of circus that happened to be popular during that period and then kind of changed and came to evolve over the course of the 20th century as the circus declined kind of got stuck in our heads. So a lot of what, you know, contemporary artists are facing and a lot of what we as an organization are facing in Circus Now, which is this community building and advocacy organization that I'm running, is trying to shed some of those cliches in favor of a broader definition of circus and, you know, a more modern, more exciting definition.
You kind of talk about circus like there was a glory era.
Yeah.
When did that end, and why do you think it's been so hard to shed that ideal in the U.S.?
They talk about the kind of golden age, the quote American golden age, being between 1870 and like 1904. Or even as far up to the First World War. What they mean by that generally is what historians mean, is that was the time when the most circuses were touring and when the shows were the biggest and the most kind of culturally relevant. As what happened basically sort of in brief is that, you know, cinema arrives in the early 20th century, things like radio then arrive, television arrives, and the idea of going to see a circus, especially going to see a circus in a tent with like 14,000 other people, full of acts that are kind of far away and acts that are maybe hard to distinguish, becomes less attractive to people. You know, seeing an elephant live is, of course, impressive, but seeing it, you know, live from 200 feet is less impressive, and maybe less impressive certainly than seeing it on a big screen, you know, where you can actually sort of ride the elephant yourself, so to speak.
Right.
So the 20th century circus declined, again, because of that, because of the challenges, economic and cultural challenges. And then I guess to answer your question, though, why did it stick in the mind so much? And it might be because the circus life itself was so fascinating to people. That when we talk about circus as a performance form, you know, it was maybe couldn't compete with cinema. When you think about circus as a way of living, or like a kind of this magical world and the magical connotations that it always had, that remained ever powerful. So over the course of the 20th century, when you had less interest in the circus, there were still books that came out every year. When circus shows were folding, there were still books coming out every year and TV shows being made about circus life and movies coming out about circus life. The problem was that it was kind of representing a circus life that didn't correspond to reality anymore.
I want to talk with you a little bit about your experience doing circus. You know, we commonly think of people, I guess now, running away to join the circus, and it's kind of a joke. But when you were studying circus in France, that's not how people perceived it there.
Yeah. I mean, I think it'd be interesting. So why do you call it a joke? In what sense was it a joke?
Maybe I heard this in a movie, but for example, so and so couldn't get into college, and so now they're going to clown school. You hear people talk about that, but that's really the exact opposite of how you describe going to circus school in the ordinary acrobat.
Yeah, and then like one of the things about the quote running away to the circus was that it became this kind of like metaphor for going and doing something crazy, right? So I mean, it was a bit of a joke, but it was also a bit of what you're describing, which is this extreme, you know, decision to run away with the circus and
right.
leave everything behind.
Exactly.
And that my, you know, the kind of what you're alluding to is the fact that in France, and I'd say all around the world right now, to go do the circus, you don't need to run away, period. Like, you can do it in your backyard by juggling. You can do it on a Tuesday night by finding an aerial class or finding an acrobatics class. And the kind of circus you're practicing or the kind of life you're living when you do that is not nearly as extreme as it was before. So, you know, I have friends who are ad executives, and they do their job from, you know, they live in New York, so they're working from like 8 a.m. to like 7 p.m., but they have these long days, and then they check out at night, and they go do aerial work, which is, you know, it's either trapeze or it's working on a tissue, a big fabric that hangs from the ceiling, and they do it because it's physical, right? And it's like something, it's almost like going to the gym for them, and it's creative because they're making up new moves, and they get to feel beautiful doing it, and there's a community to it. So it's really not that different than like going to, you know, like friends who get big into yoga or friends who get big into, you know, who go play softball at night. Circus is kind of approaching that level of cultural integration.
I also think it's interesting when you talk about circus education. I was really surprised to read in the book the extent to which there are governments in Europe that support circus schools.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of a larger conversation about the role of government in art, right? Like in the States, we don't, certainly governments give subsidies to art schools. Like I'm sure Juilliard is entirely or in large part funded by the government, but we really don't have anything like a kind of national conservatories the way they do in Canada or England or France. And so, you know, over there, the idea, it's you know, the idea of having a national theater school in America seems kind of odd to us. In France, that's not odd at all. And the same way, it's not odd for them to have a kind of national circus school, or I think they have a national marionette academy, a national puppetry academy. And all that means basically is it's the kind of state-sponsored hub for education in that discipline. And I mean, I guess what I would note too is it's interesting. Is it's funny. And you know, and when I first heard about it, and I narrate the scene in the book, and the book is really it's me being drawn into this world, right? It's me being a guy who goes away to college, who sees a circus show, who thinks it's pretty cool, and then gets sucked into it, sucked into the life, and then that's that woven with history. You know, so when I discovered the National Circus School, I was like, wow, that's crazy. Like, you know, the idea that the government would pay for circus. What I think is even crazier and what I've come to discover is that that's not an old thing. Like, it's not like some weird institution that the French had in the 20s and just kind of stuck around. They actually didn't create it until the 80s as part of this new circus movement. And then on top of that, that it's like a movement that is spreading. So you're seeing more and more countries to this day creating national circus schools.
You describe how difficult it is to get into some of these circus schools in parts of the world.
Yeah.
And I think the program you went to, you described as being having an acceptance rate lower than what it is at Harvard in the U.S.
That's right, yeah.
When you were there and you came on and started the program as a novice, didn't know a whole lot, how did the other performers respond to you?
Yeah, I mean, it's funny because there's this whole, my initial draft of the book was full of a lot of my insecurity and anxiousness about being this total horrible physical person.
Right.
And then that was cut out because it's just not that interesting. And to be clear, I got the Fulbright Fellowship, which is a national government fellowship that allows you to go to another country and study a subject. And as part of that fellowship, we arranged a deal with the National Circus School of France, wherein I would enroll in a prep program. And to understand what that is, you have to understand a bit of like the kind of pyramid that exists. So there are youth programs, kind of amateur schools, and then there's something called preparatory programs or pre-professional programs. And that's basically like, you know, it's like any kind of prep school in Europe or I guess in America, it'd be like your kind of your senior year of high school. It's a year to basically get you ready to go to the main school, which is the professional school. So I was enrolled in the prep year of the national school program. So the people in my class were not students who had passed that entrance exam. They weren't into Harvard, but they were other students who wanted to go to Harvard, so to speak, who wanted to go to the national school. And one of them actually did end up going at the end of the year. And what's funny about that is even having said that, like even though they hadn't passed the admissions test, these were still kids who had done circus since they were like 5 or 6. So think of like getting in a room with somebody who's played violin from the age of 5 when you're 23, which I was at the time, or somebody who's played soccer since that age, and it was still completely intimidating. They quite knew what I was doing there. They thought they kind of got a kick out of me. I became a bit like a mascot, right, because they're doing round off backflips and I'm working on my cartwheel in the corner, you know. They knew that I was passionate about circus. They knew that I was doing a lot of research into circus. And so I think they were generally pretty supportive. At that point, too, and this was in 2003 that I originally had the experience, there weren't really that many Americans knocking around the European circus. So for them, it was just kind of neat to see, I think, somebody from North America. At that point, Montreal had taken off where Cirque du Soleil is, but somebody from America specifically who was interested in this new form.
When you first arrived at the school, there's this really, it's really interesting to listen to you talk about, you all lined up and they had you do somersaults.
Right, right.
Can you recount what you describe in the book?
Yeah, basically as part of the initial entrance exam, and it wasn't even, excuse me, it's not an entrance exam, it was an exam to kind of figure out where we are so that over the course of the year we can then track our progress, right? And this is the first day. And I didn't know anybody who went to circus school. Like, I had a brief conversation, which I recount in the book, that kind of sent me on this journey. But I didn't know anybody personally who could, like, tell me what happened at circus school. And so I arrived, and we get there. And at that point, too, I had no idea that these other students were already so trained. I assumed they were kind of like me, just people who, you know, were kind of curious about the circus and wanted to learn some skills. And so as part of that test, you know, what they do is they walk you through from the most basic moves, so like a somersault or a cartwheel, all the way through a kind of, you know, back handspring, backflip, even double backflip. And move one was the somersault, and I'm kind of waiting there in line, waiting for my turn. And these other students start to pound through the somersaults, and it was as if the Romanian national gymnastics team had walked in the door. Like, they were sort of arcing through the air and sort of diving perfectly and spinning and popping up, and it was this perfect display of physical prowess, even though it was a somersault. And that was when I first, I think, realized that I was a bit in over my head, because I hadn't done, you know, in my kind of just exuberance to get there, I hadn't thought to, you know, do a practice of any somersaults or cartwheels, though, you know, you think one might want to do that.
Right.
it didn't occur to me to try to work on my handstand.
And you mentioned when you were at the beginning of that you didn't really know who to talk to about what happens in circus school. I think everyone thinks that. So what do you do there? Now that you teach the circus school, what types of programs or curriculum do students expect?
Yeah, it really depends on the school. So each kind of, as we talked about earlier, each culture having its own circus, the same is true for circus education. Generally, though, it's a combination of circus arts. So it'll be, you know, training in the basics is acrobatics. So everybody learns acrobatics, and that's, you know, gymnastics, basically. And then you will often train in specific circus arts. So if you're interested in juggling, you'll, you know, learn how to juggle. If you're interested in wire walking, you'll learn how to walk in a wire. And complementary to that, and this is actually what makes the circus, I think, so cool today, and part of what is really catching on and making it an activity that a lot of people are excited about, is the fact that because the new circus, the circus that emerged in the 70s, is trying to be creative and trying to be a kind of more diverse art form, the training reflects that. So you don't just do, you know, you're not just learning how to throw a ball in the air or how to do a backflip, you're also studying theater. So literally, you know, my school, they're literally acting classes taught by theater teachers. You're also studying dance. So you're learning classical dance and you're learning modern dance. And the idea is that, you know, we want to performer who is on stage, who has a presence, right? Who's able to express things, who's able to play a character if called upon. And that, if you think of your kind of old classic circus act, the performer kind of comes on, salutes the audience, does the stunt, and then goes off, generally kind of as themselves, right? Or a modified version of themselves. Whereas in a contemporary circus, you could be called upon to be, I don't know, Einstein. And now you're Einstein, and you have to beat Einstein the way you would in a theater play. But you're also, you know, there are circus skills you have to perform. And that's kind of in Montreal where I teach. There's also, you know, classes in philosophy. There's also classes in literature. I'm kind of responsible for something like the circus history / theory / analysis / what's happening in the modern circus world curriculum. And the idea is really to be developing not just the person's body, but also their mind. And that's, you know, kind of rooted in the philosophy that if you're going to be an artist, you can't just be a gymnast, right? You can't just be somebody who knows how to do a backflip. You have to be somebody who knows how to think about the world and about yourself, and then hopefully translate that thinking into some kind of expression for an audience.
And you teach circus history, so I do want to talk a little bit about the history of the circus.
Cool.
When was the first circus?
Oh, another loaded question. I mean, nothing in the circus is simple. This is the story of my life at this point. It's generally, people distinguish between the circus arts and circus kind of proper. The circus arts, which are the arts that we generally associate with the circus, clowning, wire walking, juggling, trapeze, etc. Those, with the exception of trapeze, which actually originated in the 19th century, those go back kind of time immemorial. So, you know, there were there are drawings on, or the kind of cake drawings / carvings on Egyptian tombs of jugglers. In the Chinese record, there are acrobats that go back to 3000 BC. And it really is kind of, you know, some people say that acrobatics was actually the oldest art form, that it was around before dance even, and that it originated in the shaman, you know, who were dancing around the fire or who were moving around the fire trying to enact the animal spirits, right? So if you wanted to be a monkey, you might sort of learn to tumble on your hands in order to enact the spirit of that monkey. That all kind of continued. It became a form of performance in the classical era, kind of Roman Greece. And then all the way through the Middle Ages, there were kind of traveling performers. The circus itself, though, or what we think of when we think of the circus, didn't get codified until 1768, and that was in England, when a particular equestrian master, a kind of old cavalry guy named Philip Astley, came to London and decided to create a show that combined horses, so horses running around in a ring, right, with equestrian feats, mm-hmm. and then the kind of acts I was describing before, so your acrobatics and your juggling, your tumbling.
That continued to evolve over time.
Yeah, and that was really just the beginning. So it didn't evolve actually. So Astley created the circus in 1768, and then, you know, he kind of exported it throughout Europe, and it caught on like wildfire as a form, because at that point, you know, you have to remember that people had horses. And so, you know, there were no cars, obviously, but the horse wasn't just a type of transportation. It was also, you know, the way you did work, right? The way you went to war. Horses were completely integrated into the human society. Astley then creates this form that has horses in it, and then people go and they watch people doing things on horses that they can't do themselves with all these other stunts. And so it takes off all over the world. It evolved. It evolved in the sense that each kind of culture created its own version. But what's also fascinating about that type of circus is it's really not that far from the kind of circus we think about when we have that kind of cliched idea of the circus. So, you know, even when you kind of think of a circus, what are the first things that come to mind for you?
Oh, the ringmaster and the lions,
Ringer,
probably.
Right, ring guy. So
Cotton Candy
you know,
Peanuts,
Astley
too.
Created the position of the ringmaster when he was like 37 years old, supposedly, mythically, as a way for him to stay involved with the circus, right, because he was then too old to perform. The ringmaster outfit, is there a ringmaster outfit that you think of?
Riding boots and a red jacket. Was that him also?
That was, yeah. I mean, the riding boots are from his kind of the equestrian, right, the equestrian cavalry act. And the red jacket is actually the English cavalry. So, you know, when we think of it, which is red, there's in the famous, the red coats are coming. And, you know, even the kind of classic circus tent, are there colors that you associate with a circus tent?
Red and white.
Red and white, or, yeah, red and white, or red and yellow.
Right.
Right, which were actually the red and gold of the British cavalry, too. So it's really, and it goes, I mean, to the extent, and it's kind of, this is one of the most remarkable things I found, is to the extent that, like, when you went to a circus at Philip Astley's theater in 1780 or wherever, the ring itself was 13 meters in diameter, right? And that was the kind of the size of the ring that he'd found to be the most efficient for horseback acrobatics, because it would keep, you know, imagine a guy standing on the back of a horse, it would press his feet into the horse without, so it had enough centripetal force to press his feet into the horse without being so much that kind of pulls him outward. You know what I mean?
Right.
And he kind of devised that formula. Nobody knew if it was correct, but that's what he said. If you went to any other circus all over the world, right, for the next 200 years, almost without exception, they had the same size ring, right? It was a 13 meters in diameter. Like, that's how codified the circus was for almost 200 years until 1968. Of course, there were different types of circus. So like in Paris, as we were talking about, there was a kind of aristocratic circus where, you know, the Duke and the Prince and everybody else would go to the circus on Thursday night the way they would go to the ballet on Wednesday night. And there'd be these beautiful ballerinas and tutus kind of doing pretty things on the horses. And there'd be clowns who made intellectual jokes. But even there, the ring was the same size and the acts were more or less the same.
When you set out to study circus history, there hadn't been a lot done. There was a train station ticket salesman that plays a role in this story.
Yeah, yeah. No, I mean, I'd never written a book before. Like, I didn't know what it was to write a history book. You know, like I started, and I don't consider myself a historian still. I'm a journalist slash guy who went away and did this thing and felt the need to tell the story. there are people who are super passionate about circus history, but because the art form was so generally maligned by society, because it was seen as this kind of low art form that maybe even was against intellectual development, maybe even like hurt intellectual development. There wasn't, you know, any kind of academic study of it. So there are, for instance, there's no full-time circus historian in any university all over America. And that's, you know, kind of shocking when you think about the fact that most universities, including many in Illinois, have theater and dance departments, and yet not one even studies, you know, has a full historian on staff.
Right.
So as a result, you know, people who are passionate about the circus have had to find other ways to make a living. And in Illinois, you guys are really lucky enough to have the, at ISU, Illinois State University, there's a wonderful library with a circus history collection. And one of the folks who's associated with that library is named Steve Gossard, and he wrote the kind of definitive trapeze history. Steve was not a librarian or even worked at the university, though. He worked at the train station in Bloomington. If I could say, too, another fascinating Illinois fact, which I love about, is that, you know, Bloomington today is considered, it has one of the best collections of circus memorabilia and circus literature in America. And if you ask why that is, right, Steve told me that it's because, you know, during the late 19th century, when trapeze kind of started taking off, you needed to have a big building, right, to do trapeze in, and
right.
You needed to have a place for people to fall. And at that point, nets weren't really common, right? So a lot of what they did was they would find these giant old milling houses that are full of sawdust. And they'd set the trapeze up in the milling barns, or whatever you want to call them, and then fly above and fall into the sawdust. And Bloomington, it was a milling capital, as so was Saginaw, Michigan. And so those two cities became kind of trapeze capitals of America for almost 50 years.
Speaking of trapeze, you described the first time you flew trapeze in the book. Can you tell me a little bit about that experience?
Yeah, and it's funny because I feel like trapeze is this funny thing where it's still this thing that people think of as being mythical, and I'm to the point where I think of it like a workout, you know, like at this point in my life, like I know so many trapezes and I've done it so much that it sort of feels like, yeah, I'm just going to go do some trapeze. But I you know, every time I talk about it with somebody, including my mother, you know, who is not at all connected to it, it's like, oh gosh, trapeze.
Right.
and so I kind of had that idea too in the beginning, and I was like, oh my God, like, you know, this is going to be crazy. And I got there and it was crazy insofar as, and this was back, you know, the first chapter of the book is basically about how I discovered the circus, and I see a show, and I'm kind of enamored with this new style circus, and so I start going to more shows, and then I see an advertisement for a trapeze workshop, and again, I had no connection to trapeze, I didn't know what it was, I had that kind of mythical thing in my head, too. I went to the workshop, and somehow in the conversation of, you know, my French was very bad for to begin with, but in conversing with the people at the workshop, they kind of understood that I had done trapeze already. And so when it came my turn to go up and fly off the thing, they didn't put the kind of the life belt, it's called, but the kind of harnesses. And so basically when you do trapeze, you have these ropes that connect you through a belt in order to, you know, to keep you safe for the first, you know, whatever month. And so they didn't put that on there. And so when I swang, I was kind of swinging free. And it was funny because I don't think I realized quite, I had seen the other people go with the trapeze, with the belt, like I'd seen them go with the harness, but as soon as I jumped off, it like struck me for the first time that I didn't have that. And, you know, I basically had a stroke. Like I just stopped moving and my body went, you know, I'm a literal figurative stroke. Like I just sort of went limp on the thing and hung there like this dead fish. And very quickly the people, you know, who were running the workshop realized what was going on. So they just were just like, just stop moving. Just don't stay there. Don't do anything. And so I swung until I kind of came to a stop. And then I dropped into the net. And at no point was I in any danger. Like, the net was beneath me. There was all sorts of people around supporting me. But it was absolutely terrifying. And I think because of that idea that I had of the trapeze in my head, like, I had this sense of it being something big and grand, you know, and kind of spectacularly dangerous, which, of course, it isn't. And I should mention, too, that just for any listener out there who might be tempted to do the trapeze, that never happens in America, because we have very different tort law and very different liability, and somebody would sue you to pieces if you did that. Whereas in France, they're a little more laid back about that stuff.
Right. And that was the first time you'd flown on the trapeze, wasn't it?
Yeah, that was the very first time. Yeah.
Was it difficult to do it a second time?
Mm, Well, it's funny because, I mean, as I say in the book, it was kind of that experience that launched me into going to circus school and into doing the Fulbright. So it was like, you know, in a way, it was like I was like, oh, that was so scary. But I was like, I want to do it again, or I want to, you know, what is, you know, I want to explore this world more. That I felt a kind of exhilaration that I hadn't felt in a while, and didn't even know I could feel on like a Saturday afternoon.
Where can we find your book?
You can find my book at your local independent bookstore, I presume. You can find it online at Amazon. You can go to circusnow.org or look me up on Facebook.
Great. Well, thank you very much for joining us today on Focus.
Hey, thanks for having me. It's been a real pleasure.
You've been listening to Focus on WILL. I'm Lindsay Moon, and this half hour we listened back to an interview from earlier this spring with Duncan Wall. He's author of The Ordinary Acrobat, a journey into the wondrous world of the circus, past and present. You can find out more about Duncan and his book on our website at will.illinois.edu/focus. We'll be back live tomorrow to talk about Illinois' new health care exchanges under the Affordable Care Act. Claudia Lenhoff of Champaign County Health Consumers will be here in the studio with host Jim Meadows. This is Focus on WILL. I'm Lindsay Moon. Thanks for joining us.